million if the Barnes collection is moved into town, but unwilling to raise one dime should the same paintings stay in a nearby part of the Commonwealth you govern. Attorney General Fisher, why all the sudden interest in my art collection? Where were you? And where was the oversight of your office when the Barnes Foundation was being run into the ground? The Annenberg Foundation, be careful what you wish for. Perhaps down the road, some group will seek to unravel Walter Annenberg's similarly specific gift of 52 paintings to the Metropolitan Museum. Annenberg himself required that his collection be shown as a group and banned all outside loans. Here's a solution. Why not reroute those paintings from Manhattan to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway right now? The Lenfest Foundation. Isn't Jerry Lenfest the same fellow who recently gave a permanent art exhibit consisting of 59 Pennsylvania Impressionist paintings and a $3 million endowment to the James Michener Art Museum in Doylestown? Maybe it won't be so permanent after all. And the Pew Charitable Trusts. Maybe someone should take a look at whether your meddling in this squabble squares with the intentions of the Pew family members. I'm tempted to go ask Joe Pew right now what directives he and his family left behind that you think enables your involvement. It was my fondest hope that a historically black college like Lincoln would have control of my art. And now all of these lily-white do-gooders have instead turned back the clock. If the real agenda of any of these folks was to save the Barnes Foundation, they would have been heard from long before now, and they'd be offering to raise money to bolster the endowment regardless of location. For a quarter of what Governor Rendell is promising to raise for the relocation, they could put the Barnes in clover forever. If I had died in Red China, I would have expected my property to be state-controlled, but I didn't. And as far as I know, the United States is still a place where you can work hard, accumulate the fruits of your labor, and determine what is to be done with that personal wealth at the time of your death. Judge Ott, don't let them do this to me. Everyone else wants to ignore the law. The courts are supposed to uphold it. Sincerely, Albert C. Barnes. On December 15, 2004, Judge Ott ruled that the Barnes Foundation could move from its Marion location to the city of Philadelphia, although litigation continued for years thereafter. It opened its new home on a 4.5-acre site on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway on May 19, 2012, where it has had great success. By October of 2015, the foundation celebrated its 1 millionth visitor to its new location. Todd Williams and Billy Sine Architects, a New York City-based husband and wife team, designed the Barnes' new home. Coincidentally, we were seated together at the 2016 Pritzker Architecture Prize ceremony, which I attended with my mother at the United Nations headquarters in New York City on April 4, 2016. I think they did a spectacular job, and I told them so. I particularly appreciate that the interior of the building, which houses the paintings, is a precise replica of the original gallery in Marion. The foundation's website, barnesfoundation.org, notes that visitors can immerse themselves, quote, in the greatest private collection of impressionist, post-impressionist, and early modern paintings, unquote, which consists of, quote, more than 3,000 masterpieces, including 181 Renoirs, 69 Cezannes, 59 Matisses, 46 Picassos, 16 Modiglianis, and 7 Van Goghs, plus textiles, metalwork, decorative objects, African sculpture, Native American ceramics and jewelry, and Pennsylvania German furniture, unquote. And while I recommend visiting the Barnes to all my out-of-town guests, I remain unsettled about the way in which Dr. Barnes' desires were disregarded. For those interested in the backstory regarding the foundation and the move, I recommend a 2009 documentary directed by Don Argott called The Art of the Steal. Dreaming of a non-white Christmas. Philadelphia Daily News, December 4, 2003. There's a battle underway between the coloreds and the whites Nobody wants to talk about it, even though it's got nothing to do with race relations. It's been brewing for years. The stakes are high. The survival of Christmas as we know it is at stake. To protect Christmas past will require nothing short of a rebellion. And I want it to start right here and right now. Let me explain. With Black Friday behind us, the mad dash toward the holidays is underway. You know the drill. First comes the shopping, then the holiday tipping, next the caroling, then midnight mass, and finally the gift giving. And all along the way, there will be decorating. And that's what's got my goat. It's those decorations. We've got to stop them. The white ones. They are everywhere. It didn't used to be like this, not when we were growing up. Back then, we looked forward to the Christmas season and the Christmas decorations. All of us, regardless of religion. But how did we celebrate that special time of year back then? By putting up lights on our homes and along our main streets. And not just any lights. I'm talking big, fat, colored Christmas lights. They were red, they were green, they were orange, and they were blue. They were bright, they were gaudy, and they were everywhere. And they were beautiful. They were Christmas. Every year it was the same thing, and life was wonderful. And then something happened. We got a little more education than our folks. Our jobs were a rung higher on the ladder than where they had toiled. And we moved into houses that were a bit larger than the ones in which we'd grown up. And once we got there, we somehow decided that we were no longer colored lights people. No, now we were white lights people. Yeah, white lights. Petite, non-offensive, uniform white lights. The lights of power and prestige. The lights of suburban panache and urban glamour. And so the colored lights were banished to the basement, or worse. Well, I, for one, have had enough. This emperor of Christmas present has no clothes, and I am prepared to say so. White lights are boring. White lights are sedate. White lights are pretentious. White lights are for fakers. White lights are un-Christmas. There, I said it. And I'm prepared to do something about it. I'm finished with white lights. I'm tired of being a phony. I'm returning to my roots. I'm going back to colored lights. And I want you to join me. Go to Kmart, find the colored lights, the bigger the better, pull out a ladder and put them up everywhere. Colored lights, the survival of Christmas may depend upon it. This column sprung from an extemporaneous monologue I delivered on radio 1 year prior. Coming back from a commercial break, I shared with the audience that after my program ended, I plan to pick up my wife and kids and go pick out a Christmas tree at our local firehouse, as was then our custom on my wife's birthday, December 7. Then I observed that we'd become white lights people, like the rest of the families in our neighborhood. I said that I felt I'd abandoned my colored lights childhood roots. Well, the phone lines began ringing off the hook with callers offering similar confessions, observations, of how they too had grown up in a colored lights home, but had somehow become white lights people. It was one of the more memorable segments of radio with which I've been associated. Years later, people still approach me to weigh in on this debate, and I wrote a few follow-ups in subsequent holiday seasons. For the Sunday Inquirer on December 21, 2014, I wrote, quote, "I no longer wanted to be the sort of faker who displayed white lights. And for a decade, I walked the walk. My family hung colored lights outside our home and on our tree in the family room, but not this year. The tipping point came when my wife relayed that after driving past our home, a friend, Dr. Martin Snyder, derisively referred to our exterior as Whoville. That was it. We went back to white lights." Tough questions from tough guy on 9/11 commission. Philadelphia Daily News, April 12, 2004. John Lehman. If we had nine more like him on the 9/11 commission, I'd be much more confident that we're getting to the bottom of what went wrong and ensuring it doesn't happen again, rather than continuing the high-stakes partisan skirmish that seems to have taken shape. What we've seen of Lehman's public work on the commission thus far, coupled with comments he made to me over the weekend, suggest he is prepared to call them as he sees them without regard for politics. which is precisely what the commission is supposed to do. Among those comments, the public hearings are more to please the public than to uncover crucial information about 9/11. The panel is getting plenty of vital information from officials in their private sessions. Both administrations share responsibility for allowing terrorists to complete their deadly attacks on September 11, 2001. Government agencies have done a bad job sharing information about suspected terrorist activities. And most surprisingly, the Federal Aviation Administration punishes airlines that don't follow a quota system in regard to questioning passengers. Quote, that is why you see so many blue-haired old ladies and people that are clearly not of Middle Eastern extraction being hauled out, unquote. Layman is Philadelphia's contribution to the commission. Maybe some of his no BS style can be traced to his Jesuit training at St. Joe's, or perhaps to his experiences flying combat missions over Vietnam as a Navy reserve officer. The man has an impeccable resume. This is an individual who was only 38 years old when Ronald Reagan tapped him to be Secretary of the Navy, a post he held from 1981 until 1987, all the while overseeing a massive military buildup. His importance and uniqueness among 9/11 commissioners was on full display last week when Condoleezza Rice testified. Many played to the cameras, not Layman. Maybe that's because he questions the value of the public hearings themselves, one of many subjects he openly discussed with me. Quote, really, in a way, these public hearings have been a real distraction from our mission because all of the people you have seen appear, we have already interviewed in depth. We had 15 hours, for instance, with former counterterrorism czar and recent Bush administration critic Dick Clark in private before he testified in public. So nobody on the commission learned anything, but it was felt that the public needs to understand and get a view of what was going on. However, once you put the cameras on everybody, it really becomes theater. So particularly the Democrats are under extreme pressure from the Democratic leadership not to let President Bush off the hook. Unfortunately, that brought a partisan edge to the Clark hearing and, with several of the commissioners, to the Condi Rice hearing, unquote. Layman showed in his questioning, however, that the country is after more important things than partisan bickering. Layman's focus was the transition between the Clinton and Bush administrations. He told Rice that he was, quote, struck by the continuity of the policies rather than the differences, unquote, and then he proceeded to ask Rice a series of blunt questions as to what she was told in the transition. Among his questions, quote, were you told that there were numerous young Arab males in flight training, had taken flight training, were in flight training? Were you aware at the time of the fact that Saudi Arabia had, and were you told that they had in their custody, the CFO and the closest confidant of Al-Qaeda, of Osama bin Laden, and refused direct access to the United States, unquote. Taken together, Layman's line of inquiry paints the big picture of the collective failures that enabled 9/11. But not all of what Layman asked Rice has received a public airing. This nugget was buried in the proceedings, but is worthy of more attention. Quote, were you aware that it was the policy to fine airlines if they have more than two young Arab males in secondary questioning because that's discriminatory, unquote. Huh? What was Layman talking about? This I'd never heard before. Here is what he told me, quote, we had testimony a couple of months ago from the past president of United and current president of American Airlines that kind of shocked us all. They said under oath that indeed the Department of Transportation continued to fine any airline that was caught having more than two people of the same ethnic persuasion in a secondary line for questioning, including and especially two Arabs, unquote. Wait a minute. Was Layman revealing that if airline security had three Arab guys up to no good, they had to let one go because they'd reached a quota? Quote, that is really the source because of this political correctness that became so entrenched in the 1990s and continues in the current administration. No one approves of racial profiling. That is not the issue. The fact is that Norwegian women are not, and 85-year-old women with aluminum walkers are not, the source of the terrorist threat. The fact is that our enemy is the violent Islamic extremism, and the overwhelming number of people that one needs to worry about are young Arab males, and to ask them a couple of extra questions seems to me to be common sense. Yet if an airline does that in numbers that are more than proportionate to their number in a particular line, then they get fined. And that is why you see so many blue-haired old ladies and people that are clearly not of Middle Eastern extraction being hauled out in such numbers, because otherwise they get fined, unquote. But Lehman makes it clear that he sees more institutional failure than individual failure. Quote, the real problem that enabled this shoestring operation, it cost less than $500,000 in total, to succeed and to penetrate every single one of our defenses was because of a whole series of long-standing dysfunctions in our security systems, unquote. When pressed about the differences between the Clinton and Bush administration responses, Lehman said, quote, if you look at the blame game, the Democrats are far more vulnerable because the Clinton administration was there 8 years and did nothing effective against al-Qaeda, while the Bush administration, while they might not have had as much of a sense of urgency for which they might justifiably be criticized, nevertheless, they were only there for 8 months, unquote. Reflecting that both President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore had just completed testimony in front of the commission, Lehman said, quote, all of these people feel very deeply that things are not as they should be within the government, that things could have been done much better, that we've got to make some very running changes, and some have begun, but things are by no means where they need to be. So they are not playing politics in private. That is why I think the public hearings are a distraction to our work, because we learn nothing. It's theater. But we have nothing but full cooperation and seriousness in the private meetings where there are no cameras, unquote. I asked Lehman how he believed the American people would react to the president's daily briefing of August 6, 2001, which has just seen the public light of day. Lehman said, quote, it's alarming stuff, and the president was alarmed when he saw it. It is not a smoking gun. It is a pulling together of intelligence reporting of the prior, especially 6 months, and it makes it very clear that there is a heightened activity among terrorists, that there are terrorists in the United States, and that Osama bin Laden is determined to attack in the United States. But nowhere in that daily briefing will you find anything that says Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda is going to hijack airlines and use them as weapons against targets in the United States. The whole focus was the vulnerability abroad of American embassies and American officials. The bottom line is that, yes, there is a real threat, and yes, they want to attack in the United States, but we cannot support the more extreme reports that some have sent in. Then the Bureau points out that they have 70 investigations going on in the United States, unquote. So what, then, is to be made of the president's response, or lack thereof, to that daily briefing? Quote, the whole impression from the bureaucracy to president was that we have a serious problem, but we're on top of it, unquote. If not that briefing, then, what is the most damning document as to intelligence failures that he has seen in his work of more than a year as part of the 9/11 Commission? Quote, we have over 2 million classified documents that we and our staff have pored over for over a year. This administration has given this commission more cooperation and access to sensitive documents and people than any administration in history. Everybody has been going through this, and nobody has found a smoking gun. There is no smoking gun, unquote. So where does it all lead? What can we expect midsummer when the work of the commission is made public? Lehman rattled off a pretty succinct summation of what his work has revealed and what he thinks we will read in a few months. Quote, what we have is a very clear picture that we had an intelligence community that could not penetrate al-Qaeda because of the post-Watergate era dismantling human intelligence and covert actions capabilities. We had a domestic intelligence community that was unable to penetrate the cells operating here in the United States, and those pieces of intelligence that they did have we had no sharing between CIA and FBI of these vital pieces of Al-Qaeda intelligence. We have the treating of intelligence within the FBI. Most of the FBI didn't know what the rest of the FBI had because they had a case mindset that anything gathered had to be sealed and protected because it might be used in a prosecution. We had an FAA that airlines kept totally toothless and ineffective and not carrying out its responsibilities, and we had an INS that Congress wanted to keep weak because they want open borders that illegals can penetrate. We had a system endorsed and supported by two administrations that allowed cities like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and Houston to pass laws prohibiting their police from cooperating in any way with immigration and naturalization. People were saying, and the Clark testimony implied, that the Bush administration was told everything, when in fact they were told nothing about what the real problems were, and they were the things that really enabled Al-Qaeda to do what they did, unquote. No wonder John Layman is anticipating a final report with, quote, very, very far-reaching reforms, unquote. I say hand him the pen and let him take the first crack. This column stands out as the most consequential and maybe the longest I ever wrote for the Philadelphia Daily News. It propelled the publication of my first book, Flying Blind, How Political Correctness Continues to Compromise Airline Safety Post 9/11, although no such book was on my mind when I wrote the column. Perhaps the reason why I was drawn to the subject of profiling and airline security post 9/11 is that just before I wrote this column, in March of 2004, my family of six was heading to Florida for spring break when something disturbing happened. At a ticket counter in the Atlantic City airport, my 8-year-old son was singled out for secondary or random screening. I thought it was utterly ridiculous, nothing more than window dressing to give comfort to the people standing in line who had more in common with the 19 on 9/11 and were also about to be given a heightened screening. Then, on April 8, 2004, I saw Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice testify before the 9/11 Commission. And after listening to Secretary Layman's questioning of Dr. Rice, especially the question that began, quote, were you aware that it was the policy, unquote, I was very eager to have him on my radio program. We recorded the interview 2 days after the hearing, on the Saturday of Easter weekend. Maybe that had something to do with Layman at his home in Bucks County being so relaxed and speaking freely for 35 minutes. When the conversation ended, I felt that what he told me couldn't wait for publication until the following Thursday's Daily News. So I spent Easter Sunday writing the column, then called Daily News editor Zach Stahlberg at home and told him what I had. Zach connected me with Michael Days, the newly appointed managing editor who ran my story the following morning with front page promotion. It was also picked up by the New York Post and Investors Business Daily, which gave my reportage on Secretary Layman and profiling new legs. I was invited to appear on CNBC's Kudlow and Kramer, and after being interviewed by Kramer, the Department of Transportation immediately issued a statement saying that what I'd reported was incorrect. Bizarrely, when I asked for a copy of the statement, they wouldn't give it to me. That only made me want to dig deeper to learn about profiling in a pre- and post-9/11 world, and what I found appalled me. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the Department of Transportation fined 4 U.S. commercial carriers millions of dollars for alleged discrimination as they sought to prevent a repeat of the terrorism. Stunningly, those punished included United and American Airlines, which lost 2 airplanes apiece and a combined total of more than 30 of their own personnel on 9/11. Continental and Delta were the other 2 airlines fined. The DOT, under Norman Mineta, initiated discrimination complaints against United and American that were settled for $1.5 million apiece. I read the litigation files and would later testify before a Senate subcommittee as to what I learned. As I have previously summarized, the fact patterns were similar. Picture a pilot in the cockpit ready to pull back from the gate. He's got a schedule to keep. And he has a statutory obligation to see to it that anyone who is perceived to be, quote, inimical to public safety, unquote, is removed from the aircraft. Then comes the knock on the cockpit door, and the pilot is told, either by someone from the flight crew or someone in law enforcement, that the person in seat 3C is of Middle Eastern descent, that they have been acting in a suspicious fashion, and that their name, or one very similar to it, is on a federal watch list. What should we do, Captain? And to the extent that the pilot agrees to have the passenger questioned while he goes ahead and departs, our government perceived his actions to be discriminatory and initiated legal proceedings against his airline. Had the DOT not challenged me for repeating layman's assertions in print and in my interview with Jim Cramer, I probably would never have written Flying Blind. How to get Quasimodo a date. Philadelphia Daily News, April 22, 2004. Legalize it. That's my reaction to the publication of the photos of 16 quote-unquote Johns recently arrested for prostitution in Philadelphia. What an outrage. Just who decided that the press should be judge, jury, and executioner? These men should be facing the wrath of wives and girlfriends, not the Fourth Estate. Don't get me wrong, it's terrible that people wake up to the sight of used condoms on their stoops. The oldest profession has no business in residential communities, but the fact that this seediness is all around is just another justification for making it legit, which would let us control the location, the participants, and the revenue. No politician is willing to say this. Good thing columnists don't have to stand for election. Instead, they'll talk about the need to protect neighborhoods by going even further to embarrass the Johns, perhaps by putting their faces on cable TV. Ridiculous, I say. The mugshots published in the Daily News revealed a random sampling of American men, white, black, Hispanic, and Asian, of all ages. My first thought? Poll them and find out who's really winning the presidential race. Of course, it's the school principal among them who is drawing most of the attention. No wonder the police department was reluctant to give up the information. You have to worry that one of these guys will kill himself as a result of this latter-day version of the stocks on the town green. That's happened elsewhere. And what happens if one of the guys whose picture was published is exonerated? As Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Labor once asked, where will they go to get their reputation back? And the attention on the principal is misplaced. I'm more interested in the guy who turned out to have a rap sheet that includes a rape conviction. He did 3 to 7 for it. Having him pay for sex sounds to me like a good thing. What might he do if he had no place to go and get it? Spare me the letters saying that rape is a crime of violence, not sex. As far as I'm concerned, when the rapist pays for sex, he's at least not abusing someone else. Want to get sex out of neighborhoods? Then legalize it. Give those who want to do it a place to go far away from our homes. Surely a country that says a woman can determine the fate of her fetus can let her decide to accept cash instead of a few drinks for sex. This way, we not only determine where it happens, but we regulate those involved. Take a look at the adult film industry in Los Angeles right now. The business has gone dark because two stars were determined to have AIDS. This is a billion-dollar industry closing up shop on its own initiative. In L.A., the 1,000 or so porn stars are all tested monthly and show the results before they can work. Is the system perfect? No, but it is a hell of a lot better than the open season on many urban streets right now. One of the porn stars returned from shooting a movie in Brazil on March 17. Unfortunately, Brazil doesn't exercise L.A.'s oversight of the industry. The day this guy returned, he tested negative. Falsely, it turns out, because of his recent infection. So he went to work. When tested again on April 12, he was diagnosed. It's an ugly situation. Now 65 people are scared to death that they too are infected, but it could have been worse. At least the circle is defined and the initial case was caught within 1 month. Imagine if that happened with the hookers on the streets of Philadelphia whose clients were outed last week. How long would it have taken for a diagnosis? How in the world could potential victims be identified? And there's one more reason for legalization. Call it the Quasimodo conundrum. Simply stated, some guys are never going to find companionship. I say guys because women never have this problem. That's just the way we're wired. Aren't the Quasimodos entitled to a little happiness, particularly in a world where sexual stimulation is all around? It's all about sex, and if that's tolerated, so too must a means of dealing with the effects. Yes, legalizing prostitution is still my view, and I've repeated it in other columns. Beyond the Quasimodo factor, I'd add the following virtues to legalization: increased odds of sex workers reporting crimes against them, the decrease of STDs, and a decline of sex workers, all of which came to pass after New Zealand decriminalized prostitution in 2003, as detailed by a government commission study of the impact. And it's not just the Quasimodos and sex workers I'm looking out for. I'm protecting politicians, too. When in the spring of 2013, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, the victim of his own prostitution scandal, sought to resurrect his career by running for New York City comptroller, I defended his right to run and said it could well pose the final referendum on sex scandals if he won, even though he didn't necessarily agree with me. Maybe he was right. He lost. Guest hosting for Chris Matthews on Hardball, I asked Spitzer if we'd become too intrusive, and he said, quote, "Look, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask because I have a perspective that is so tailored to what I have been through, and I might separate those questions. Have we become too intrusive? Have we lost all sense of privacy? Yes. I think that's a larger issue that we as a society need to confront. I think maybe there's an important conversation there. Is it the end of the sex scandal? No. Am I in any way condoning what I did? Absolutely not." Unquote. I'd argue that we lose potentially good public servants when we evaluate their work capabilities through the prism of their private lives. That's not a defense of Spitzer's patronizing hookers, but rather an opinion that his inability to honor his marital vows is not necessarily a reflection of his ability to comport himself on the job, which is why I told Spitzer that while his wife should have thrown his clothes into Central Park, I didn't think his stint as client number 9 was a job impediment. The following day, again anchoring Hardball, I delivered a commentary, and I said this, quote, "I would argue that it's time to bring the world's oldest profession above board in communities willing to allow it, clean up the trade, and clamp down on the exploitation. Let government share in the revenue, but otherwise stay out of the private affairs of consenting adults. Beyond the role of the tax man, prostitution doesn't warrant the involvement of federal authorities." Unquote. That commentary earned me a negative headline at the right-wing website Newsbusters, quote, "Smirkanish fawns over Spitzer," unquote. No, I was just defending the idea that his sex life was his wife's business, not ours. A brush with greatness, thanks to a little truancy and some connections. Philadelphia Daily News, June 7, 2004. "I once skipped school just to meet Ronald Reagan. No regrets. It was the spring of 1980. I was a senior at Central Bucks West and about to vote for the first time. Despite my age, the presidential race had captivated me, largely because of my fondness for a guy running for the office who was 50 years older than me. A week or so ahead of the election, a friend named Charlie Giroux, then a regional campaign coordinator for Ronald Reagan, called to say that Reagan would tour the Italian market in South Philadelphia the next day. He told me that if I were standing inside Esposito's meat market at exactly 2:50 p.m., I'd probably get to shake his hand. I decided to try. I recruited a buddy from my neighborhood, Mike Stockel Jr., and together we rode the train into the old Reading Terminal shed. Then we hoofed it down to 9th Street. The scene was bedlam. The go-go 80s were just beginning, but this was old school politics, buttons, bands, banners, and open access to a man who might be the next leader of the free world. From a distance, we watched Ronald Reagan get out of a town car in front of Giordano's at 9th and Washington. It was hard to see, much less to get close to the man who people still addressed as governor. So we walked a block or so north and headed into Esposito's. There was no one around. "Are you sure he's coming in here?" my friend asked. I had my doubts. Things were too quiet. and then I spied a large catering plate with a huge length of sausage spelling out Reagan. It was a good sign. I figured we must be in the right place. Sure enough, minutes later, in walked Ronald Reagan and what we then thought was an army of Secret Service, although when viewed through 2004 glasses, it was really just a few guys. That was it. Ronald Reagan, some security, the meat cutters from Esposito's, and the two punks from Bucks County who should have been in class. I had a pocket Instamatic in my hood. They were all the rage at that time. I asked Ronald Reagan for his permission before we used it. In person, Reagan was a big, broad-shouldered fellow with inviting eyes, and he was a gentleman. "Hold on, fellas, I need to blow my nose," I remember him saying. We did, and then we snapped away as he smiled and gave the feeling that he had all the time in the world for two young men barely of age to vote. The guys from Esposito's presented the sausage while we were flies on the wall. I'd never heard the word gravitas back then, but I knew Ronald Reagan had something special, something tough to put into words that I immediately felt from being in his presence for a few moments in a meat store in the heart of the Italian market. Call it Ronald Reagan's gift. It was a feeling that he exuded. Grandfatherly, might sum it up. To be close to him was to trust him and to feel that he had your back. He emitted strength and an air of sincerity, a rarity among all people, but particularly in our public servants. Even bad news was welcome if it were to come from his lips. And while he'd made his name on celluloid and carried with him a certain formality, he nevertheless had a rugged sense of American independence and grit. He was a man's man. We were like giddy school kids when we got back on the train. Hell, we were school kids. But a few days after the trip to the Italian market, I was crushed. I hadn't wanted to carry the flash attachment on the train, and as a result, the photographs were of a terrible quality. I didn't know it then, but I would soon get another chance. Late that summer, Charlie Giroux called again. Ronald Reagan, now the Republican Party candidate for president, was coming back to Philadelphia, this time for a fundraiser at the Bellevue with Arlen Specter, the GOP nominee for the U.S. Senate. The date was August 18, 1980. The price was $500 per person. Giroux told me that if I played my cards right, I might be able to crash. There were no guarantees. I put on my only sport coat and headed back into the city. With a purloined name tag, I quickly gained admission. Ah, the good old pre-9/11 days. This time, I had not only my pocket Instamatic, but also my flash. I handed the camera to a stranger when Ronald Reagan worked the rope line and the mystery man snapped just one shot. That's all it took. I look at it often. It's me with a fat 70s-era tie and a full head of hair standing with the Gipper. I treasure it to this day. While I would be in his presence on several occasions, none would equal the initial feeling I had inside Esposito's. Those struggling to understand the enormity of the loss his death represents surely won't include people who got a chance to meet him. When Charlie Giroux turned 60, Lou Esposito surprised him with this photograph of his unique sausage gift for the future president. Fortunately, he made me a duplicate. It's just the way I remembered all these years. Jim Beasley, the People's Lawyer. Philadelphia Daily News, September 23, 2004. A legal giant will be laid to rest today. But we'd be doing Jim Beasley a disservice if we were to recall him as a great, quote-unquote, Philadelphia lawyer, a moniker that may still carry a connotation for skill and competence, but also conjures up privilege, white shoes, and Ivy League degrees. Jim Beasley was none of that. He spent most of his 78 years slaying dragons. He was a trial lawyer, and damn proud of it, even when it became a term of derision. For 50 years, he reigned as the preeminent litigator in all of Pennsylvania. The range of his clients and breadth of his cases was unparalleled. Google Jim Beasley, and you'll read about his beating the Philadelphia Inquirer twice on behalf of Dick Sprague, or his representation of the family of Holly Maddox against the man who murdered her, Ira Einhorn. He made headlines when he obtained a judgment against Iraq for 9/11 victims. Many thought of suing, but it was Jim Beasley who figured out how to serve the members of the Taliban with legal papers. But there were also the everyday unpublished stories of thousands of clients who were united only in their status as the underdog. Injured workers, victims of medical neglect, consumers injured by unsafe products. Beasley gave a voice to ordinary people who otherwise would never have had the ability to take on large insurance companies and Fortune 500 corporations. Size mattered to Beasley. The smaller the aggrieved party, the more apt he was to become their champion. And his outrage was palpable. In this day of blow-dried pettifoggers, the jury felt and shared his sense of outrage. Lawyers desperate to learn the secret of Beasley's success would travel great distances to watch him try a case or host a seminar. Quote, "You have to believe in your case," he'd say, "because a jury can tell when you don't," unquote. But the skills that he used so effectively in court didn't come from a textbook. His roots were the key to his success. His humble upbringing and thorough preparation gave him a unique ability to speak simply and convincingly. Jim Beasley was once a kid born on the wrong side of the tracks in the midst of the Depression. He grew up poor in West Philadelphia, the son of a factory worker. He spent his summers working his grandparents' Mississippi farm. At 17, he dropped out of high school to join the Navy. After his discharge in 1945, he worked briefly as a cop and then returned to Philadelphia. He drove a truck, a cab, and a Greyhound bus, and quickly realized that he had to go back to school. So he enrolled in a VA program and put himself through Temple Law School, which now bears his name, by working at night. Then came the stuff of legal legend. Like when he represented the teenage victim of an airline crash and walked into court holding a phone. During his closing speech, Beasley brought out the phone and invited the jurors to imagine themselves in the boy's home so that they could, quote-unquote, overhear the call in which his parents learned of their son's death. With the power of his spoken words, he crafted an image of cinematic size that was as poignant as it was vivid. Then, with a blend of common sense and a not insignificant bit of flair, he told the jury that they would control the message in a call yet to be made, in which the airline lawyer would report the jury's verdict to the plane's manufacturer. It would be up to the jurors, he said, to decide what would be reported in that call. I sat at his elbow and watched him treat all clients, from the mayor of Rome to a welfare mom from North Philly, with the same dignity and respect. Beasley didn't care about skin color. He wasn't interested in your politics. Your station in life was irrelevant. His only interest was the plight of his clients. And for them, he was a gunslinger. These days, it's enough to sneer contemptuously at those trial lawyers, as if the title itself connotes dishonesty or opportunism. No need to qualify the title with an adjective, dishonest. It's bad enough just to call someone a trial lawyer. No doubt some will see the career of Jim Beasley as one spent in an attack on American commerce. But that would be a mistake. We can thank Jim Beasley for the fact that our cars are as safe today as they have ever been. Newspapers think twice before publishing something that destroys a reputation. Hospitals have implemented protocols that save people from getting the wrong medicine, and factories use machines that are less likely to injure working people. People who think we would be better off without trial lawyers have simply been fortunate to never need one. And somewhere, somebody should now be chiseling, quote, "Here lies James E. Beasley, trial lawyer," unquote. Pennsylvania lawyers have a continuing legal education, CLE, requirement, which commands us to spend 12 hours every year listening to lectures about ethics and the conduct of legal practice. Ever since Jim's passing, I'd had an idea to present a CLE program focused on him, with the support of David Arena and Lisa Mensch at the Pennsylvania Bar Institute. In March of 2015, we staged a three-hour seminar entitled Lessons Learned from the Legendary James Beasley Sr. I moderated the discussion in front of a room full of lawyers in Philadelphia and simulcast to attorneys all over Pennsylvania. The participants included the Honorable Sandra Mazur Moss from the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas, in front of whom Jim had often appeared, James E. Beasley Jr., who now runs the Beasley firm, Shane Inspector, and Tom Klein, both of whom were mentored by Jim before creating one of the most successful trial practices in the nation, and Peter Hoffman, a defense attorney against whom Jim had tried many cases. The legendary Richard Sprague, Jim's close friend and former legal client, sat in the audience. As is the custom for such CLE programs, the speakers prepared written materials for the attendees. My contribution was a lengthy memo, which I described as a thoroughly incomplete list of things that I had learned in my 10-year association with Jim. Most were tips for lawyers, such as the Beasley style of writing a letter. Jim liked to often write, quote, "You know that I know that you know," unquote, and he did it deliberately. The way that Jim liked to interview prospective clients, how he'd get them to summarize their claims in writing, his aggressive style of taking pretrial discovery, how he'd interview prospective jurors during voir dire, his special skill of persuasion, and his work ethic. But under the headline of friendship, I also offered this, quote, "Outside the courtroom, Jim could be prickly. He maintained a very small social circle, but for those allowed to enter, he was a good friend and better dinner companion. He enjoyed a glass of wine, loved to tell stories, relished a dinner debate. When our wives joined us, he would view my spouse's presence as an opportunity to sound her out on potential cases. Christmas seemed to matter to him. He never missed that gift exchange. I recall when my kids were young, we surprised him at his remote Villanova home on Halloween, and sans candy, he responded by going into his pocket for a 20. He also acknowledged the birth of each of our children with a note, and I will always remember him making an unsolicited call to the delivery room at Lankenau Hospital during the birth of our first son, making it clear to the nursing station that Jim Beasley was calling to make sure everything was all right. I was touched, but also maybe a little concerned that the OB would drop my son upon hearing who had inquired. Dreaming of a White House Christmas. Philadelphia Daily News, December 23rd, 2004. Allow me to tell you about a memorable night at the White House last week. One which included my telling the president that he'd been mentioned in a letter sent to Santa by one of my kids. The occasion was a White House Christmas party attended by my wife and me. What a thrill. We have four children, three boys aged 4, 6, and 8, and a teenage daughter who's 16 going on 30. Our 8-year-old son met the president at a campaign rally in Yardley just days before the recent election. I emceed the event, and when it was over, Senator Santorum introduced me to the president. My son was at my side, I had my digital camera, and so when the president greeted my namesake, I took a photo of them, albeit not at the best angle. Chalk that up to suddenly unsteady hands. No wonder my son voted for W in his school's mock election, and he hasn't stopped talking about his chance encounter. Even when writing to Santa, he told old Saint Nick that he, quote, "means as much to me as the President of the United States." I thought the president would get a kick out of the note to Santa. My chance came soon after my wife and I entered the East Wing and joined the receiving line of the Christmas party. After a, quote, "welcome to the White House," unquote, greeting from a uniformed staffer, we'd walk past a photo display of the Reagans at Christmas, beyond the first of many beautifully decorated Christmas trees, and through a room with First Lady portraits. Standing in the receiving line, I had my son's letter to Santa in my pocket, along with the photograph I'd taken of him with the president. Now, my dilemma. The event was structured with military precision. We would be formally announced as we greeted the president. We'd shake hands and pose for a picture. In other words, keep moving. Quote, "Michael and Lavinia Smirkanish," unquote, someone called out. There we stood, shaking hands while a photographer clicked. Quote, "our son wrote to Santa Claus to say he respects him as much as he respects you," unquote, I said. He asked me my son's age. I took it as an opening. Quote, "you met him during the campaign," unquote, I said, and pulled out the letter and picture to show him. My eyes were fixed on the president, who seemed touched to hear the report. My wife told me later that I gave the Secret Service a stir when I reached for the letter to Santa. The president asked if he could sign the picture to my son. I told him it wasn't necessary. He ignored me, asked his name, and penned a greeting. We were then free to explore 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The entire first floor was open without restriction. Gone were the stanchions that limit the public tour. We were able to navigate the rooms, sit in the furniture, and get a close look at the breathtaking art collection. The trees were all white and lit with candlelight bulbs. The president has yet to join my colored light brigade. This was clearly a red state party. Most people posing for their own photos, one of them taken under the Ronald Reagan portrait or near the creche in the East Room. There was no waiting line at Hillary's portrait. The menu was a mixture of some politically correct low-carb stuff, Western-style wraps, some tame sushi, and a dish or two of pasta. Red and white wine flowed, nothing French. The eggnog tasted good and spiked. Karl Rove was circulating, but the cloakroom staff provided more interesting conversation. When retrieving my wife's coat, I said I felt sorry for the president having to pose for pictures all night. One fellow told me that the Reagans had the party down to a science. Quote, when they wanted you to leave, the band would strike up, hit the road, Jack, and people did, unquote. My wife and I did a few of the White House Christmas parties with the Bushes and were together for one with the Obamas their first year in the White House. Then she said that she'd had enough, take the kids. So I did. In subsequent years, I took each of our four children and then my mother and finally my brother. The only close family member I did not get to take was my dad. We had planned to go in the final year of the Obama administration, but he was unable to travel, and so neither of us attended. Good thing I was able to share the experience with so many, as I am not anticipating any similar invites from President Trump. Cause case. It's Kobe all over again. Philadelphia Daily News, February 17, 2005. I told you so. With Kobe, I mean. From the start of that case, I said it didn't pass the smell test. All I needed to hear was that the alleged victim showed up for a rape test the next day with semen that didn't belong to Kobe on her shorts. Huh? And now I'm ready to say the same thing about the cause. This one doesn't wash either. It defies logic that a woman wakes up feeling that she's been drugged and violated but doesn't call the police. And then, one year later, according to her father, only after receiving training on the ethical boundaries of massage therapy, she realized that she should call the police? That, plus the fact that the Philadelphia Police sexual assault report says, quote, according to the Canadian police interview, her recollection is poor, unquote, tells me any criminal case is a loser. I know, this makes me an insensitive male, but there will be other insensitive males on the jury, and they'll never buy it. And on the gender bias that seems to dictate perception of these cases, I'm tired of the argument that says those of us who are circumspect about an alleged sexual assault claim do a disservice to future victims. I say it's actually the initiators of weak claims who do future claimants a disservice. Remember, if claimants in sexual assault cases never lied, we'd never see acquittals, but we do. Bottom line, this is a criminal case that won't be filed. And if it's filed, it'll never succeed. On the civil side of things, maybe she files and he pays her to go away. Bruce Castor, the Montgomery County DA, is perfect for the Cosby case. He's tough and a straight arrow. He won't be intimidated by the possibility of a celebrity defendant, nor will he cower in the face of those who want the man charged. If you need a reference on his work, just seek out Craig Rabinowitz, Caleb Farley, or Guy Saleo. But Castor is now the subject of criticism for comments he made about the case, some of them on my radio show. I've heard his words twisted by people who claim that Castor tipped his hand. I checked the tape. He did nothing of the kind. Here is what he did say. Quote, you will find no place that I said the case is weak or anything of that nature. What I said was that, under Pennsylvania law, delay in reporting inures to the benefit of the defendant unless there is some good reason why the victim waits to come forward. there is a presumption in the law that a prompt complaint goes to the credibility of the person complaining. The reverse is also true. Juries tend to believe that a delay in reporting means that the victim did not think that what happened was so bad and that some intervening event made her decide she wanted to go ahead and complain. Where you see juries sympathetic to delay is the type of case where you have a child complaining, unquote, Castor said. Was he tipping his hand? Was he insensitive to the alleged victim? Hardly. He was simply explaining the legal realities of the review he is duty-bound to apply. Consider this. After a Pennsylvania jury in a case of alleged sexual assault hears all the evidence, here is one of the instructions read to them by the judge. Quote, the evidence of delay in making a complaint does not necessarily make her testimony unreliable, but may remove from it the assurance of reliability accompanying the prompt complaint or outcry which the victim of a crime such as this would ordinarily be expected to make. Therefore, the delay in making a complaint should be considered in evaluating her testimony and in deciding whether the act occurred with or without her consent, unquote. That's what Castor was talking about. He was explaining that this is something he must consider when deciding whether to charge Cosby in a case that would appear to be a he said, she said. But some people wear blinders on this topic. They think that if the conduct involves sex, the credibility of an alleged victim should be off limits, which is ridiculous if all you have to go on is her word. This same logic applies to the latest voice in the case, the lawyer from California who now claims that 30 years ago, the cause assaulted her too. Where has she been? In part, defending herself against disciplinary charges in front of the California bar. Are we supposed to ignore those revelations when all we have to go on is her word? I think not. Here is one final way of looking at it. Bill Cosby is presumed to be innocent. This is a case where she claims he did something and he claims he didn't. One of them is lying. If he is presumed to be innocent, it means she is presumed to be lying until shown otherwise. She has to move the needle. And based solely on that which has been printed about the case to date, I doubt she can do it. Yikes. In my defense, I wrote this column long before 50 or so women came forward and told similar stories about Cosby. Nevertheless, I did later write about the way Cosby was treated by the judicial system, specifically how, despite a confidentiality agreement in a long-settled civil suit, a federal judge allowed the release of portions of his sworn deposition testimony, truly the decision, which opened the floodgates for those many accusers to come forward. I still think that decision was wrong. As I wrote for the Sunday Inquirer at the time, quote, that Bill Cosby will be forever known as a serial abuser of women wasn't determined by findings of a jury. It didn't come down to evidence such as forensics, DNA, or even a blue dress. Instead, his fate was sealed in the court of public opinion by an adjudication of his hypocrisy. Beyond the legalese, that was the true predicate on which Judge Eduardo C. Robreno based his decision to unseal documents related to a civil suit filed against Cosby 10 years ago, unquote. I was referring to the fact that in his ruling to release portions of Cosby's testimony from the civil case, the judge reasoned that Cosby had, quote, thrust himself into the vortex of these public issues, unquote, and therefore, quote, voluntarily narrowed the zone of privacy that he is entitled to claim, unquote. One of the ways Cosby had done so, according to the judge's footnotes, was by giving a speech about personal responsibility in the black community on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. In other words, had Cosby stayed out of the public policy arena, the deposition excerpts might have remained sealed. But because he was a public moralizer, he opened the door to be refuted by discovery motions and their supporting documents from 10 years prior. I didn't buy the logic then, and I still don't. My willingness to offer that nuanced legal defense of Cosby in his prosecution surely played a role in what happened just before the start of his criminal trial. In May of 2017, my iPhone rang on a Friday afternoon while I was preparing for the following day's CNN program. On the line were Andrew Wyatt, a public relations professional, and his client, Bill Cosby. They wanted to offer me audio for use